This document, Civil Commons in Practice, is an empirical case study paper exploring how real-world institutions across water, health, education, and ecology attempt to prioritize human life capacity over financial pressures.
Getting right into the feedback, the paper's individual case studies are meticulously structured, but the cross-case comparison misses an opportunity to explore the dynamic friction between these wildly different global examples.
Yeah, I mean, the way the text isolates each case is, it's really rigorous. You have this 10-question template dissecting six distinct models.
Right, from the remunicipalization of Paris's water utility to the EBIS primary care system in Costa Rica.
Exactly. But is there a risk that focusing solely on isolating each case within this template might, you know, overlook the messy real-world intersections where these models could clash or learn from one another?
I think that's the core weakness here. Because when you get to section 9, it just abruptly transitions into a summarized table.
Yeah, a table and a brief list of six shared conditions. It leaves the synthesis significantly under-theorized.
By keeping the cases completely siloed right up to the end of the analysis, the paper successfully tells the reader that a shared civil commons grammar exists, but it fundamentally fails to demonstrate how that grammar actually works under pressure.
You just get the components, but not the interaction.
Right. I mean, how does an ecological hybrid like Costa Rica's Payments for Ecosystem Services, the PES model, conceptually challenge a heavily integrated state-funded model like Finland's comprehensive education system?
Wait, because the PES model uses financial incentives, right?
Exactly. It literally pays private landowners to protect the forest. It's market adjacent. Meanwhile, Finland is a non-market, completely state-driven system.
And the current structure of the text just sort of flattens those vibrant, inherent contradictions between the cases. It puts them side by side like they're just, you know, perfectly harmonious.
Which they aren't. They operate in entirely different conceptual universes.
So the suggestion here is to elevate that cross-case synthesis by explicitly mapping the conceptual tensions and overlapping vulnerabilities between the cases, rather than just, like, listing their shared traits at the end.
Yes, create a direct dialogue between the models themselves.
Okay, so what does that look like practically? What's a concrete example?
Well, the author could explicitly contrast the specific risks facing Paris and Porto Alegre. In Paris, the remunicipalization of Eau de Paris is this top-down state-driven process, right?
Right, so the vulnerability there is bureaucratic centralization. The state holds all the cards.
Exactly. Now, pit that directly against Porto Alegre's participatory budgeting, which is entirely bottom-up. It relies on grassroots citizen assemblies.
Ah, and the vulnerability there is participation fatigue. The citizens just burn out from endless meetings.
You got it. And by contrasting those two, you demonstrate how the overall framework accounts for both extremes of the governance spectrum.
That's a great angle. Another concrete example could be using the Costa Rica PES case as a direct foil against the Te Awa Tupua case.
Oh, the Whanganui River settlement in New Zealand? Walk me through that comparison.
Well, Costa Rica uses market logic, right? They tax fossil fuels to pay for carbon sequestration. They use apital to protect the life ground.
Right, they price nature to save it.
Exactly. But Te Awa Tupua does the exact opposite. It uses indigenous legal personhood to completely bypass market logic altogether.
Treating the river as an indivisible living whole.
Yeah. So exploring that tension between pricing nature versus recognizing its inherent personhood proves the robustness of the author's analytical lens.
That's fascinating. And obviously, pairing up Paris and Porto Alegre or Costa Rica and Te Awa Tupua, these are just a few out of all possible ways to restructure that synthesis.
Sure, they could mix and match any of the cases. The point is just to make them interact.
Glee fail. Which brings us to the next point.
Right. The exploration of how civil commons become life blind relies too heavily on abstract definitions rather than grounding these vulnerabilities in the paper's own empirical evidence.
Section 10 is frankly pretty jarring. The author outlines 8 specific failure modes, concepts like market capture, elite capture, political reversal.
But they're presented in a purely conceptual vacuum. It's like reading a fascinating manual on historic shipwrecks that lists hull breach and navigational error in the glossary, without ever actually examining the sunken ships we just toured in the previous chapters.
That is the perfect analogy.
The weakness is that these failure modes are completely divorced from the rich, historical realities of the case studies we just spent dozens of pages reading about.
And the paper repeatedly claims to take a non-romantic approach to institutional analysis.
Right. But by cleanly separating the theoretical failures from the actual flawed case narratives, it inadvertently shields the case studies from the very scrutiny it promises.
I mean, take Porto Alegre, for instance. The text vaguely references the 2017 suspension of its participatory budgeting, but it actively avoids digging into the real-world mechanics of how that collapse actually unfolded on the ground.
Which is such a missed opportunity. The collapse of Porto Alegre is a terrifying, perfect example of how fragile these systems can be.
So the suggestion is to anchor the abstract failure modes directly inside the empirical case narratives to show the exact mechanics of institutional collapse or vulnerability in action.
Let's give a concrete example of how to do this. When detailing political reversal, the author shouldn't just, you know, define the concept academically.
Right. They should explicitly dissect the timeline of Porto Alegre's 2017 suspension.
Exactly. Show the reader exactly how shifting electoral cycles or a loss of leadership support actively dismantled this specific civil commons.
Because when Mayor Nelson Marchesan Jr. took office, he didn't just ban it outright, did he?
No, he cited a financial deficit and simply refused to execute the budget allocations that the citizen assemblies had decided upon.
Oh, wow. So the institutional vulnerability was that the executive branch still retained the ultimate veto over the capital flow.
Yes. The system relied entirely on the goodwill of the sovereign. That is the actual mechanical failure the reader needs to see.
That grounds the theory so much better. We could apply that same approach to ecological abstraction, right?
How so?
Well, instead of explaining the theory of how environmental protections get disconnected from reality, drill deep into the Costa Rica PES program.
But the PES program successfully reversed deforestation. It's a huge success story.
It is, but look at its foundation. It's heavily reliant on a national tax on fossil fuels.
Oh, I see where you're going.
Yeah, as the country transitions to a green economy and fossil fuel consumption drops, the revenue stream for forest protection dries up.
That is a massive paradox. You have a life-coherent institution that literally requires the continued burning of fossil fuels to sustain its budget.
Exactly. And that proves practically, not just theoretically, how vulnerable a civil commons becomes when it remains tethered to extractive money sequence funding.
If the money sequence falters, the life ground protection crumbles.
Right. And using Porto Alegre's timeline or the Costa Rica tax structure, those are just a few out of all possible ways of solving this problem. You could do it with any of the cases to prove the point.
Grounding these failures in the paper's own selected cases really forces the framework to prove its diagnostic power. And highlighting the granular mechanics of these institutional failures brings us directly to the paper's proposed antidote, which is the concept of repair.
Yeah, this is the crux of the whole piece. The concept of accountability to repair serves as the paper's defining conclusion, yet the practical mechanics of how institutions actually execute this repair remain vague compared to the detailed mechanisms of service access.
The text builds massive momentum toward this idea that institutions must remain accountable to repair where they disable life.
And that makes perfect sense. Without repair, even a well-intentioned public system eventually becomes a machine for structural violence. But could the evidence also support a more rigorous definition of how an institution detects and fixes its own harm without relying on the very bureaucracy that caused the harm in the first place?
And it doesn't do that right now. That is the weakness. While repair failure is listed as a mode of collapse and repair is featured as a dashboard indicator, the text rarely operationalizes what institutional repair actually looks like in practice.
I was looking at Appendix C, and it lists things like participatory oversight and grievance systems as safeguards.
Right, but aren't those just standard administrative tools?
Exactly. A grievance box in a clinic waiting room isn't transformative, life-coherent repair. It's just paperwork.
Yeah, if a marginalized patient is systematically dismissed by the Costa Rican eBay's health model, a complaint form doesn't automatically restructure clinical practice. It just vanishes into a bureaucratic void.
The overarching framework demands a much higher standard of accountability, but the operational examples provided just don't match that standard at all.
So the suggestion here is to expand the operational definition of repair by using the most robust empirical example already present in the text as a universal template to evaluate the other case studies.
And we have the perfect model sitting right there in the manuscript.
The Te Awatupa case.
Yes. As a concrete example, the author should elevate the Whanganui River case as the ultimate empirical template for institutional repair.
The text already mentions its historical redress, but it needs to detail exactly how its co-governance structure legally enforces repair.
Let me push back on that a little bit, though. Te Awatupua is an indigenous legal framework designed to recognize a river ecosystem.
Right.
How does that legally binding restoration fund practically apply to a highly bureaucratized European system like Finland's education model? Aren't we risking forcing a square peg into a round hole?
It's a fair question, but it's a translation of mechanics, not a literal copy. Te Awatupua established a specific multi-million-dollar contestable fund dedicated solely to the health and well-being of the river, managed jointly by the Crown and the local iwi.
Okay, so how do you map that onto Finland?
The author should explicitly ask, what is the equivalent of that mechanism in the education system? When Finland inevitably fails marginalized students or faces rising inequality among immigrant populations, where is the dedicated, legally binding restoration fund managed jointly by the affected community and the state?
Ah, I see. So you are using the rigor of the river settlement to expose the administrative passivity of the education system.
Precisely. We're demanding the author flesh out specific, active dashboard indicators for repair across all the domains.
That makes total sense. Another concrete example would be revisiting the EVIS health model we mentioned earlier.
Right, the grievance boxes.
Yeah, instead of just listing grievance systems, the author needs to detail what specific active feedback loops ensure that community grievances bypass the bureaucratic ether and directly trigger a mandatory review of clinical practices.
The institution must be structurally forced to adapt to the harm it causes.
And to be clear, establishing dedicated restoration funds or mandatory feedback loops, those are just a few out of all possible ways to operationalize repair. The author might find other mechanisms within their research.
The overarching point is to define action, not just intention.
Right. That's the crucial difference between a paper that merely describes a theoretical framework and a paper that successfully deploys one.
By forcing these cases out of their isolation, by grounding their failures in actual history, and by operationalizing their capacity for institutional repair, the analysis transforms into a truly functional tool for evaluating policy.
Absolutely. To recap the critique for this document, the paper establishes a brilliant, highly structured grammar for evaluating life-coherent institutions across the globe. But it can maximize its impact by tightening three key areas.
First, explicitly map the dynamic friction and conceptual tensions between the cases in the cross-case synthesis, rather than leaving them siloed.
Second, anchor the theoretical failure modes directly within the historical realities of the case studies to fulfill the promise of a non-romantic analysis.
And finally, operationalize the vital concept of repair using the Te Awatupua case as a rigorous, practical template for the other institutions.
The listener is highly encouraged to apply these actionable suggestions and submit the revised draft back in for another round of constructive feedback.